Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, both of my guests today had a profound impact on me when I read through their work getting ready for the show, so I hope they will for you too. Coming up around 12:30 today, we'll delve into rediscovering that essence that lives under the surface of who we think we are, and who better to do that with than psychologist Dr. Pavel Somov. That's coming up around 12:30 today. But first, I'm very pleased to be joined by award-winning artist, writer, and sculptor James Mendel Joseph. When he was just 15 years old, he received critical acclaim for his first mural. He's a graduate of the American Academy of Art and continued studying at the Art Institute of Chicago. He's earned numerous honors and awards, and his work has been exhibited across the United States and featured in Architectural Digest, Time Life Books, Playboy, the Chicago Tribune Magazine, and more. He's just released a new book and joins us today to explore art and survival in the 21st century, a creative response to the challenges of our time through drawing, painting, and sculpture. James Mendel Joseph, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you so much, Vicki. It's good to be with you and with your listeners. I appreciate the opportunity.
And you said it's okay to call you Jim, so I'm just going to call you Jim.
That sounds great. The show. It makes it much less complex.
Yeah. But you have such an interesting background. You have been quoted as saying, art is your personal journey. It's your personal journey into inquiry. And you can't imagine doing anything else. I wonder if you'd share a little bit about what you mean by that.
Yes, of course. So often we are a product of our society and the beliefs contained within that society. And in a sense, they become blinding to us, to who our real reality is. You know, ultimately, we are all multidimensional artists. And, you know, the canvas that we paint on is life itself, and that's all of us. First of all, I'd like to take people out of the usual way that they view art, which is kind of esoteric, and it's out there somewhere in the Metropolitan Museum or in the Louvre. And, you know, my teacher told me when I was in third grade I wasn't much of an artist, so I stopped drawing.
What did that person know?
And what I'm suggesting, and I invite your listeners to really be with this, is that we are all artists. And, you know, I don't say that casually. If you look at the way we are, we love the color. We pick out the color of our car, our clothing. We want to set a beautiful table. We love flowers. And all of us have that quality within us. Oftentimes it's been suppressed, you know, whether it's our job or the routine, we're on the highway all day or what, and that child within has been suppressed as well. And that's the real tragedy. It's no accident that we're hardwired as children to play. You know, that's really about our survival. Mm-hmm. That inquiry, that excitement, that wonder is what makes us fully alive and connected to everything around us. So what do we do? And I've talked to a lot of very concerned teachers about this. What do? We take these wonderful children, bright eye. Why, Daddy? Why, Mommy? Why? You know, what about this? What about that? We take those children, we put them in school at an earlier and earlier age. We deprive them of play, you know, art and playing with various things. And we put them in a desk and we start testing them for information that we think is important, which may or may not be to their, well, certainly won't be to their creativity.
Right.
And then we say, you know, you better get this test right. So immediately fear comes in. They're 6 years old. Already they're fearful. Am I going to give the right answer? And what we expect as educators and teachers and a society is to have them regurgitate the answers that we have provided for the test. And if they don't, they feel terrible. What we're experiencing at an earlier and earlier age is depression among young children. They're shutting down.
So
now, can you imagine had Einstein or Edison been subjected to this testing? You know, they were incredibly incorrigible in school.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah. Many geniuses and creative people, you know, were not interested in school. I mean, they would have drugged me out right away. I mean, I got to tell you, I was looking out the window, watching the birds in the trees, and drawing my fellow students. And, you know, had I been subjected to what's going on in today's society, I probably would not have had this aliveness and this creativity.
So what was it that encouraged you, Jim, to move forward with your art? Because I know you've said you can't imagine doing anything else. I know in your background, you're related to two very famous artists. Did you grow up in a creative environment?
Well, the truth is I didn't. I grew up in a very dysfunctional, immediate family, and I say that with great love. Because they let me run the I was a street kid. They let me run the streets and discover everything for myself. I got into a lot of trouble, I got to tell you. I joined the Marine Corps at a very early age. I lied my age, and I wound up in Korea at 18 after I had already been in the Marine Corps for a couple of years, having lied my age. And, you know, I was wounded a couple of times, and it was an iconoclastic experience. Everything that I had believed up till that time had been shattered.
Mm.
And that's the word iconoclastic literally means breaking the icons. You know, all the beliefs that we regard as truth. So I had to reestablish what is it that I need to do with my life. And in a sense, I had a survivor's guilt. Because so many of my, in fact, most of my friends were killed.
This is the Korean War, right?
This was the Korean War at Chosin Reservoir, and, you know, we had very high casualties. And I had this survivor's guilt, and I said, can I begin to peel back the layers and understand what it is that drives humanity? What is it that drives our particular culture? And can I contribute in some small way? Can I be the voice for those who have lost their voice? And so that became a challenge for me. And fortunately, I was involved in, you know, in advertising, public relations, health. I wrote for several health publications. So I've had a wide-ranging experience, a very holistic experience in my life, and I've been able to filter through all of that, the disinformation, the misinformation that our culture is just overwhelmed with. You know, all the isms, you know, the communism, terrorism, these are only words that do not express the reality of why we're where we are in the world. So that's a political statement, but say, so what does that have to do with art?
Well, I'm interested in how you got from commercial art, because you said that you realized that you were just playing a part, and you were playing a part in a business that you didn't obviously want to participate in.
Yes. Actually,
so how did you make the transition into doing the kind of work that you do now?
Well, you know, thank you for that question. No one has asked me that. That's a very good question, because I think, and I know this for a fact, that we're much more than this physical being walking around. If we express an interest by our actions, not by, oh yeah, I'd like to be, but mm-hmm. by our actions, mm-hmm. we get help from the universe. You know, we can call it God, we can call it energy. I prefer to call it energy because God is so sullied. That word, you know, has so many do you believe in God? Well, what do you mean by that? You know, I mean, every religion has their own interpretation. I prefer to call it universal intelligence that has, you know, has this incredible, you know, miraculous energy that's throwing up new life forms all over the universe. And if you look carefully, this is what art is all about. You see life inexorably flowing from everything. For example, I did a painting which was rather complex. It's in the book, but in the foreground, it looks, you know, like, wow, there are a lot of problems here. But if you look carefully, you'll see that there's a flower growing up through the asphalt. So we've created asphalt, cement, concrete, and yet life inexorably wants to break through on every level. And that's what excites me. So what happened is, as I was doing advertising and as I was doing public relations and all the writing and all the things that I did, I started to be drawn back into my background, which was a street kid, and I would ride the subways and I would draw people and all the varieties and the different ethnic types and racial types. And I got really involved. So on my lunch hours, I would go over and I would draw Skid Row. This was in Chicago. And I would go into what was then called the ghetto, you know, the black ghetto, because I grew up with black kids and I loved them. And I, you know, I grew up in a multiracial, multicultural environment. So, and I was struck with the fact that I could grow out of my environment by just putting a suit on and combing my hair and cleaning up my language. This was not true for some of the people, you know, the mm-hmm. African Americans. They could not do that. There was all this racial bias. So I did all this work and I submitted it to people, and people loved my work. So I did the largest series of black history paintings. Up to that time, they traveled on the Freedom Train. I did 30 black history paintings. I took over a year to do them. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience. And from that, other things just kept showing up. So this is the key. People have to have faith that if they have a direction, a sense of what it is they want to do with their life, things will show up and clear a space for them. And it may show up like more difficulties. It's not going to say, oh, wow, we love you.
Right.
It's going to be a challenge.
Well, you certainly had a lot of challenges, and I'm sure putting this book together was a challenge for you. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk some more and start looking a little bit about the work that's gone into the book and share some of that with our listeners. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is James Menzel Joseph. His book is called Art and Survival in the 21st Century. Beautiful piece of work. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com, and if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Eric Lamet shares the true story of a Jewish boy and his mother in Mussolini's Italy. And New York Times bestselling novelist Heather Gudenkauf shares how secrets can keep you caged in her latest story, These Hidden Things. That's all coming next Monday at noon Pacific time on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Get your smile on with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back. We are talking in this segment with James Menzel Joseph. His new book is called Art and Survival in the 21st Century, a creative response to the challenges of our time through drawing, painting, and sculpture. And Jim Menzel, is an award-winning artist, sculptor, and writer. And I'm very pleased to be talking with him today. Jim, I wanted to talk a little bit about your book because it's such a beautiful piece of work. I mean, it's a creation in itself.
Thank you.
I know you've poured 6 decades of your background and experience and observation into this. You talk a lot about the power of observation throughout the book. But you also raise some really interesting questions. And a quote at the beginning of your book, you say, "It may be that peace and balance in the world will come through our individual awakenings. The process of creating has the power to change who we are and, by extension, our world." So tell us what you set out to do when you began creating this book.
Well, basically, my hope was to have people experience the joy and the excitement and the possibilities that art provides and that I have experienced. I just wanted to really share this experience that keeps us alive. You know, I also do some health consulting, and one of the things I've discovered is that people that do not have passion in their life, their bodies start to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than looking at the heart disease or whatever, we need to first, and not that that's not important, to look at the mechanics and, you know, all the pathology. But what we first need to look at is, do we really want to continue to live fully? And that's why art is so important, because it allows us to live fully. We start to see the connections. When I'm out doing a landscape, it's so magical that what happens is the separation between the landscape and my painting it begins to disappear. The ego, me, disappears into the wonder of that landscape. The beauty that it represents now becomes part of me. And if there's one problem that our culture and every culture has to struggle with, it's the illusion of separation. If I could leave your listeners with one thing to ponder, it's the illusion of separation is the cause of all conflict. So we can only war with each other and war with ourselves and have all those horrific feelings because we feel separate, estranged. And out of that separation comes fear. And this is an artistic statement I'm making now, because ugliness derives out of fear. The battlefield is an ugly place to be. I can attest to that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're in love, everything around us looks beautiful. Have you noticed that, Vicki?
Oh, yeah.
You know, wow, let's get some flowers, and how about a cake, and let's have fun.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So we can choose to live our lives out of love or out of fear. And love and fear cannot occupy the same space. It's just impossible. Try it sometime.
Yeah, it's very true. One of the questions you raised, Jim, is can we summon the courage as artists to hunt down the unvarnished truth? How do we go about that?
Well, one of the things that one has to do as an artist is be in unfamiliar territory. In a sense, get off the path and start going into the rough and, you know, pushing aside some difficulties away from what people normally believe is true, and actually discovering, first, inquiring deeply, because that's what art is really about, inquiring, penetration, and then discovery. And then that discovery leading up to another one. It's like a treasure hunt, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the other questions you raise at the beginning of the book, and you say that our very existence may depend on answering these questions. Can our art generate an honest dialogue about the times in which we live? We still have censorship, whether we think we do or don't. Often it's dictated by corporate sponsorship. So how do we generate through art that dialogue and make sure it's honest about the times in which we live?
Because art really invites us to be honest. If we put aside the ego is developed. I like to, you know, use, I'm imagery. I'm an imagery kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say, you know, when we're born, we're this beautiful, bright-eyed, wondrous being, you know, with all kinds of potential. And now we're born into these bright lights, and they do all these pharmaceuticals and, you know, horrible, you know, things right away. So you're introduced into this. Instead of normally what would be born, what would be happening, you would have loving people around you, the wise women of the culture would be around you. It would be a dark, warm place. The child would have the umbilical cord still remaining and crawl up to the mother's breast with some addition and still hear the mother's a heartbeat. That would be a normal culture. You know, that's what indigenous people always did. We ripped the child away from mother, put them in a... I mean, there's some of this is changing now, but I'm just giving you an example. Put them in a bassinet, and when we get them home, we wheel them into a supermarket of ideas about who they are. You know, all the labels and products that are in supermarkets, and we load that, you know, that shopping cart up with your, you know, your Christian, Muslim, whatever, and we start piling in this identity. And this is who you are. You're white, you're black, whatever, and you're a girl, boy, and we paint the rooms that color. Incidentally, pink, I will tell you, is the worst color to paint a room. It's very disempowering. That's been proven scientifically.
What color did you say? Pink.
Pink.
Really?
Absolutely. You know, the football teams, they try to paint the visitors' locker rooms pink so that they don't have the same kind of energy that they normally would have.
Wow.
Color is energy.
That's interesting.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we fill this supermarket, and this kid comes out, and by now he's 18. You know, he's got all this stuff piled in his shopping cart, and he spends the rest of his life defending those values. And he's willing to not only kill for them, you know, not only die for them himself, but to kill others for them. And what art does, it gets you out of that. You have to be an observer. You have to be willing to give up what you thought were yesterday's truths for today's new discoveries. Now, look at our political landscape. Sorry about that, folks. I mean, really look. We have no imagination. We keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Right.
I mean, how crazy is that? Okay? So what I'm inviting people to do is to be truly who they are. Rediscover why they came on this planet with all this life energy and all the possibilities and all the curiosity.
Now, you talked a little about, you know, we have love or we have fear. And you discuss the, you know, many people are fearful of unleashing their creativity, if you will. How does one discover one's muse?
First of all, we need to turn off the television.
Yes. I love the comment you made in the book where we said that, you know, our aliveness is literally going down the tube.
Is that true? You know, what I have to tell you, Vicki, this is something I was very fortunate about because as a child, I grew up with radio. And I have received my education through listening to radio while I'm creating my paintings, drawings, sculpture, and all the other. I don't write while I'm listening to the radio. That's the only thing I don't do. And, you know, I've talked to, you know, young kids, and I said, well, what do you like better, radio or TV? And they said, we like radio better because the images are better. In other words, our imagination is enlivened.
Yes.
And when we just, you know, sit like drones in front of, you know, in this couch and watch these images fly by, and, you know, a lot of studies have been done on this, but it's very, very clear that nothing is going on inside the head that's useful.
Yes, a lot of very significant studies have proven that.
Absolutely. So, you know, first of all, we have to take back our power. And this time of, you know, a decline in economy, we're getting the message that we should have gotten very early, and indigenous people tried to tell us. And I'll go back to this whole idea of the illusion of separation again. You know, if I'm standing at a tree, you know, metaphorically, and I'm looking at that tree and all the trees that surround it as lumber, and, you know, I could build a lot of houses and make a lot of money.
Right.
Let's cut down these trees. That's a separation. That tree has nothing to do with me other than it's outside and it's a commodity. Everything is a commodity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to look at that tree, but a realistic way, and this is not a romance or romantic in any way, a realistic way to look at that tree is part of me. And if I keep cutting down trees, I am literally killing myself. Well, how is it a part of me? Because it's my lungs. It's my outside lungs. So there, when I say outside, inside, what we begin to see as artists and as observers, and whether you're a writer, whether you begin to see that everything is connected. So those trees are giving me the oxygen that I breathe. And they're also absorbing the CO2, you know, that I exhale.
Mm-hmm.
So inspiration means to breathe in, inspire. You know, when we conspire, we're breathing together. So in effect, we're conspiring with that tree if we understood that. So how many trees can we cut down and not have that CO2 sink that they provide and not have the oxygen? And we're already seeing we're suffering because of the lowered oxygen. We don't have the CO2 sink that we once had, you know? So all of that, that's just one simple example of what an artist can begin to see.
Mm. Well, I have a lot more questions I'd like to ask you, Jim, but unfortunately we're at the end of our segment today. I want to say that you leave readers of your book by saying our times have the potential to bring about an unparalleled creative renaissance. Now is the time for us to imagine and birth this renaissance into being. I know earlier you said that if you could leave our listeners with one thing, it would be the illusion of separation is the cause of all conflict. Anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, I just invite all of your listeners to be as creative in whatever way they can. Gardening is a good place to start. Reestablishing community, that's connectedness. And realize that your art, your life, is an art form. And handle it joyfully and beautifully and with great respect.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Loved the book, beautiful artwork, and I loved the writing that went with it too. And it certainly made me think differently, and that's what it's all about, right?
Yes, it certainly is. And thank you so much for this opportunity to be with you and with your listeners.
You're very welcome. And my guest, James Menzel Joseph. He normally, you'll just see him up as Menzel Joseph in many places. His book is called Art and Survival in the 21st Century, A Creative Response to the Challenges of Our Time Through Drawing, Painting, and Sculpture. And there's over 150 of his original pieces of artwork shown in this book. It really is beautifully done. And you can find out more at his website, which is artandsurvival.org. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking about the Lotus Effect. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
And it died without a sound. Your skin so pale against the fallen autumn.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Conscious living for conscious people. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we're talking now about the Lotus Effect. We're talking with Dr. Pavel Somov. He's a licensed psychologist in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he's the author of Eating the Moment and Present Perfect and a few other books, as well as this new one, The Lotus Effect, Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. He's successfully used mindfulness-based interventions with substance abusers in recovery, and I believe he emigrated from Russia at the age of 21. Let's bring him on and find out more. Dr. Pavel Somov, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
So you're originally from Russia?
Yes, from Moscow.
And you came here when?
About 20 years ago when I was 21, 1991, actually. The very day I was boarding the plane to the United States, there was the last Russian coup d'etat.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh, did you cause that?
That's a curious question. In the universe in which everything is interrelated, I guess I could probably claim some karmic footprint in that.
Now, on your website, it says your approach to your work is to provide people with support and leverage wellness and motivation for change, to facilitate personal growth and relational well-being, to provide feedback. Let's talk a little bit about the work that you do on a daily basis, and then we'll take a look at the book. So tell us a little bit about your day-to-day practice.
Well, I mostly just see clients and right in between. Just your ordinary psychologist in practice, in private practice. I do mostly individual work, although I do love couples counseling, and I do groups now and then. Most of what I do, I guess, from the technical standpoint, is sort of an eclectic mix of mindfulness-based therapy or existential logotherapeutic metacognitive interventions. It's really hard to put a finger on it. It's mm-hmm. just basically sort of a clinical tool belt of sorts, and whatever seems to be the shortcut to well-being is what comes to
right.
the foreground.
Right. Now, you've written several books, I know, and this new one is called The Lotus Effect.
Yes.
Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. How would you describe this book to people?
Well, it's not a typical self-help book. It actually begins at square one. It allows you to redefine the very concept of self in such a way as to prevent many of the self-help issues that we encounter in life. So in that sense, it's sort of a break in the paradigm. As evidenced by the title, the book is based on the metaphor, the lotus effect, and the flower lotus has been a long-standing symbol of resilience and enlightenment in the East, and the reason is partly because it's beautiful, but also it's a very smart flower. It's got a kind of natural Raynex quality to it. It sheds dirt like a well-treated windshield on a car. So the idea behind the book is to facilitate the kind of lotus identity that allows you to shed suffering. It allows you to survive any change in circumstance, be it a job loss or a relationship loss, without the loss of self. So we're talking about a psychological Raynex. We're talking about cultivating Teflon mind, if you wish.
Mm. Yes, which is sometimes a very good thing to have. I want to share a story because I think this kind of it kind of parallels a little bit about what you're talking about. And it was a story of the Golden Buddha. I'm sure you're familiar with that since many of your meditative techniques are based on Buddhism. But I just came across this story the other day, and there was a temple being moved in Bangkok back in the mid-1950s, and there was an ugly gold-painted plaster statue of Buddha there, and the monks didn't really want to move it, but they thought they should. And apparently, as the Buddha was being lifted, the cable on the crane broke, and it dropped to the floor and cracked. And It started to rain, so they just left it there. And next morning, a monk goes out and takes a look at this this horrible, ugly plaster Buddha. And he started wiping away the mud that had collected from the, you know, the rainfall. And as he did that, he noticed that the wet plaster was cracked and there was something shiny underneath. And when they chipped off the all of the ugly old gold-painted plaster, they found a solid gold Buddha, 10.5 feet tall, 2.5 tons of solid gold, worth just under $100 million. And it kind of, the work that you're doing in here had, a similar parallel in that you're trying to get people to uncover what they really are. You're trying to get them to ditch what they're not.
Exactly. It's not about being gilded. It's about discovering the gold within. It's a great segue. I really appreciate your story. It totally lines up with the message of the book. We're not the surface. We're what's within.
Right. And one of the things, so how did you come across the story of the lotus seeds? Because there was a story I read in the beginning of the book where it said the lotus seeds were 1,000-plus years old.
Yes. Well, actually, a couple of years ago, I was working on a project, which I'm yet to publish, called Skin of Being. And basically, I was fascinated by the idea that the very essence of life, as it seems, is structurally connected to the idea of a membrane. So when you look at a human cell, basically, it is hydrophobic. What keeps it together is the fear of water, if you wish. So there are these bipolar molecules. They're oil on one end, and they're oil loving on one end, and water fearing on the other end. And that sort of creates the architecture of the cell. That's what creates the membrane surface and the surface intelligence and all of the subsequent functions of intelligence, so to say. So I was fascinated with that idea, and I came across the reference to lotus effect, and I realized that the lotus effect is both a technical term and a wonderful parallel to the idea of discovering your essential self.
Yeah, and much of what you write about in the book is about disidentifying from what you're not. So
yes.
I just want to set that up and and talk about neti-neti, because you use this phrase a lot through the book. So
yes.
Tell us a little bit what neti-neti means, because this is one of the tools that you'll have us use to disidentify and uncover our real selves.
Sure. The phrase neti-neti is actually from Upanishads, which is one of the most ancient texts on the planet, and what it literally means in Sanskrit is not this. So when in the book I use the phrase neti it out, what I'm saying is that I'm inviting the reader to set a precedent of consciousness of disidentifying from what they're not. Let me give you a sense of what I mean. Just a couple of months ago during Christmas time, I was watching my 14-year-old niece play a video game. And it's one of those shooting monsters games. She's going through tunnels. And the game is hard. She keeps losing. And as I watch that, my initial response, sort of a stereotypical response, is that this seems to have some addictive quality. This seems to have some obsessive quality. But then I realize that actually what I'm observing is lotus effect in progress. And what I mean by this is this, that she enjoyed the challenge of the survival because she was psychologically independent of the avatar on the screen. Avatar is a Hindu term for character or representation of something. So she has an avatar on the screen, and she is using this avatar in order to win the game, but at the same time, she is not allowing herself to be defined by what happens to the avatar. So the idea in the Lotus Effect book, in the Lotus Effect project, is to realize that the very self-concept that we have, this informational ego that we carry, this self-image, this self-view, this too is an avatar. So when you realize that you're not your thoughts about yourself, when you realize that you're not your favorite self-descriptions, when you realize that you're not your sensations, your roles, your circumstance, when you realize you're not any of these things that you tend to identify with, you come into this sense of psychological invulnerability. And the process that I lay out in the book is a kind of methodical program of looking at a variety of different mirrors and saying, am I my life? Am I my information? Am I my circumstance? Am I my possessions? Am I, you know, what other people think of me? Am I my own thoughts about myself? Am I my own experiences? Am I my own body? And as you go through that process, you realize that actually it's pretty much impossible to say what you are. You're not any of these things that you used to think you are. And this is the disidentification process. This is the liberation idea that allows you to recognize that what you are is actually ineffable. It's beyond description. It's not verbal. It's a process, not a thing.
Yeah, and this is so important because so many of us do get caught up in that, you know, whatever it is, I'm a real estate broker or I'm a doctor or a dentist.
Exactly.
And you go much further than that. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to go into that because you actually give some great meditative tools. And this had actually quite a profound impact on me reading through your work this weekend. So I'd like to share some of that with our listeners today.
Sure.
And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. Pavel Somov. His new book is called The Lotus Effect, Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
The new mainstream of talk radio. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. So happy to show up.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment with Dr. Pavel Somov. He's written a new book called The Lotus Effect, Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. And on the book jacket here, it says, the locust plant has a unique ability to survive in muddy, humid swamps, producing beautiful flowers that bloom just above the water's surface. By repelling dirt and parasites from their leaves, lotuses are able to thrive and access as much sunlight and water as possible. So what if we, like the lotus, could let the trials and tribulations of everyday life slip away and emerge unscathed and whole? And that's the metaphor that Dr. Pavel Somov uses throughout his book here. I want to talk in this segment about disidentifying, because so often when we go into meditation, we are, you know, it's still important to ask the question, who are we? But sometimes we also need to recognize what we're not. And you talk a lot about disidentifying. And one of the things that I'd like to address here is, I am not my job. How do we go about separating ourselves? Because especially in these economic times, I think people are clutching onto their roles and titles, and ultimately we are not our jobs. So how do we go about letting that go and disidentifying from that?
Well, Vicky, the process of the book is really that of developing an insight and then deepening it. So in a matter like this one, you know, when we talk about the jobs, it seems to be on the surface to realize that we're not what we do. For example, you introduced me as Dr. Pavel Somov. Am I a psychologist? Of course not. This is what I do, but I don't do this all the time. So this lacks permanence to qualify as an anchor of identity. So in a sense, when we're talking about identity, we're talking about something that is always the same, not something that is just there a lot. You might have a very demanding job, a job that requires a lot of your attention. Say you're a full-time parent. And even though it might feel like you always are a parent, you aren't when you're asleep.
Mm-hmm.
You aren't when you're driving. You aren't when you're on the john. So the idea here is to realize that that which is fleeting, that which can be taken away from us, cannot be fundamentally a basis of identity. You know, I could lose my license and I could not practice psychology anymore, or God forbid a parent could lose a child and they're not a parent anymore. So basically, as dear as these attachments are to us, as organizing as they are, it is essential that we realize that we're not these things that we do. You're not a radio host, even though you're probably very good at that. It's something you're doing at the moment.
Right.
But you aren't that when you're, for example, watching a movie. So the idea behind this identification is really that of cultivating this insight that we are not our circumstance. We're not that which is changing. We're that which remains the same in and out of the circumstance.
And how do we deepen that understanding through meditation?
I'm sorry?
How do we deepen that understanding through meditation?
Sure. Well, the very basic idea of mindfulness-based meditation is to actually disidentify. We usually don't think of mindfulness as such. As I see it, mindfulness is really not about filling up your mind. It's about stepping back from your mind. So actually, a better description of mindfulness is mindlessness, if you wish. When you sit down in a classic form of Eastern mindfulness, the idea is to notice the experience and to not become part of it, to let it come and to let it go, i.e. to disidentify. In fact, mindfulness has been really described in a very technical sense as a process of disidentification. So when you spend some time in this kind of metacognitive mode, in this kind of witness mode, in this kind of observation mode, you realize that you're not your experience. You're the one who has it, but you're not the experience. The experience comes and goes. And when you understand that, then much of the shallower, many of the shallower false selves, they just fall away automatically. You know, if I'm not my own thoughts about myself, then I'm certainly not your thoughts about me, just like you're not my thoughts about you. So in a sense, the idea here is to try to pull the rug from underneath our fake self legs, if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that answers your question.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you'd finish that. So the other thing that I see a lot of is we take things personally about, you know, with an outcome. We may have a terrific outcome of something, which of course feels very good. But conversely, we may have, you know, we may not achieve the outcome that we expected, and we may not get the results that we wanted, which doesn't feel so good. So how do we disidentify from that?
Again, the idea is to understand that there is no outcome without us. So obviously, we're not a function of the outcome, but the outcome is the function of us. In fact, outcome is the outcome of our behavior. Outcome is what comes out of us. We don't come out of the outcome. It's the outcome that comes out of us. So you can look at this semantically, and you can sort of dissect it semantically and logically, or you can just look at the self-evident idea that we are not the trophies we won, we are not the grades we got. You know, I'm not my GPA from, you know, years back. These things happen, and then they disappear. They come and go, this, you know, pats on the back, failures and successes, but we remain. So obviously, we're not that which comes and goes. We're that which remains.
Right. Through the book, you talk about re-identifying who you are. Obviously, we need to de-identify, first of all, and then re-identify who we are. And you have a theme running through this segment of the book, which you call am-ness.
Yes.
I wonder if you'd talk about am-ness, am-ness, and tell us what you mean by am-ness.
Well, grammatically, amness is the process of being, not the state of being. It's sort of the backdrop of existence. It's incredibly difficult to explain this verbally. That's why I use the metaphor in the book. But basically, amness is that which is always there. Right now, you know you exist. Now, you're taking different kinds of forms. You know, right now, you're listening, then you're going to be talking, you might be thinking such and such. So we go through a variety of transformations. We change form from a moment to a moment, but what remains is the very fact of our existence. That is the amnes. Imagine a lava lamp, one of those glass cones with wax that's heated and
right.
transforms from moment to moment.
Right.
If we were to watch a lava lamp, it looks differently from a moment to moment. You know, right now it might look like almost a perfectly spherical blob, and maybe 15 minutes from now it'll look like a dumbbell. So the lava goes through a change of form, but the wax of it does not change. That's the amnes of the lava lamp. We are the wax. We go through forms, but the essence remains. We're that which exists. We're not the information, but that which is in the process of formation, existence itself, life.
Okay.
Not the forms that it takes. And, of course, none of this is really particularly helpful unless you actually sit down and go inside. There are many different kinds of jumping points here. The most obvious one is just to ask yourself, what am I? And as soon as you do that, you recognize that your mind is spitting out a certain answer. And you recognize then that this answer is just another thought that comes and goes, and you remain. And then you realize that you're not your thoughts about yourself, you're that which remains, the amnes of your experience, not the thisness or thatness of your experience.
Okay. Makes sense. You talk about perennial growth, and you say consciousness is a secret we'll share. What do you mean it's a secret we'll share?
It's a very curious semantic puzzle, if you wish. The very word self actually stems from Sanskrit root term se, which means separate. So the word self and the word separate are synonymous, and so is the word secret. The word secret also traces back to the exact same semantic Sanskrit root term se, which means separate. So that's one semantic puzzle. And the other semantic puzzle is that the word consciousness is really basically the same as saying shared knowledge. So what is the shared knowledge that we possess? What the shared knowledge that we possess is that we're not our forms. We're the essence of our existence. And that's kind of what I was trying to say in the book. And functionally, the idea behind this realization is to help you facilitate compassion and forgiveness, to sort of facilitate a platform of identifying with others on the basis of your sameness, not on the basis of your differences. We're not the differences between us,
mm-hmm.
because we differ from a moment to a moment. So obviously we're not our own differences, nor are we the differences between us. So what are we? We're that which remains the same. And curiously enough, that which remains the same about you is the same thing that remains the same about me. And when you realize that, you go from this kind of psychological invulnerability on a personal level to a sense of compassion and forgiveness as you relate to other human beings. In my own life, for example, I used to mindlessly, you know, operate without much concern for other species. You know, I loved my dog, of course, and I, you know, never abused animals or anything of that sort, but I didn't really pause to think about, you know, the stink bugs in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And all of a sudden, 4 or 5 years ago, when I began to really figure this out, everything changed. You know, when I look at a stink bug in Pittsburgh, even though I don't like its form, I, on some level, realize that the essence of it, the existence of it, the amnes of it, is not altogether different from the amnes that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates an entirely different handling of that matter.
Right.
I bought such a thing called Bugzooka. It's a kind of suction device that allows you to humanely pick up a bug and let it out outside, as opposed to, you know, grabbing a paper towel and smooshing it and tossing it in a trash can.
Ah, see, I need one of those, because right now I have to scoop it into a bucket because I don't like touching them.
Yeah,
but I don't like killing them either.
Yeah.
Well, this is a really interesting topic. It's a very in-depth talk. We're trying to squeeze 200 pages here in a very short period of time. And unfortunately, we are at the end of our segment now, Dr. Somov. But I just want to share with our listeners that at the end of the book, you say, give yourself permission to suffer. There's a Russian saying, mourning is wiser than night. What, say that in Russian for us, would you?
Утро. Вечера мудренее. The morning is wiser than the night before.
So bottom line, we have a problem. Sleep on it, right?
that too. But I guess what I'm also trying to say with that is that we metabolize information just like we metabolize food, and there is a certain rite of passage to that. So just because something is under your skin, it doesn't mean that it's not going to pass.
Okay.
There's never been a thought that didn't go away. There's never been a feeling that didn't go away. There's never been a sensation that didn't go away. So
okay.
Even if you do nothing, the suffering is going to abate on its own somewhat. But
it's
you can facilitate that process by actively disidentifying from those experiences.
Right. Thank you. And we have to go. We have to rush off now because we're right out of time. Dr. Pavel Somov, my guest, his book, The Lotus Effect. And you can Google him and find out more about his book and his work. And I thank you for being with us today. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.